This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. In 2006, the British comedian Sacha Baron Cohen became an international sensation thanks to his starring role in Borat. It was a movie in which he pretended to be a clueless and bigoted TV reporter from Kazakhstan, improvising outrageous exchanges with unwitting U.S. citizens and politicians. Sacha Baron Cohen is up to his old tricks again in a new movie, but with a different character, a flamboyantly gay fashion reporter from Austria named Bruno, who also has conversations with people who aren't in on the joke. He crashes fashion shows in Europe, vies for celebrity in Hollywood, and even tries to broker peace in the Middle East.
Why are you so anti-Hamas? I mean, isn't pita bread the real enemy?
You're confusing Hamas with hummus, I believe.
Hummus has nothing to do
with Hamas. Do you think there is a relation between Hamas and hummus?
So was the founder of Hamas a chef? He had created the food and then got lots of followers?
Hummus has nothing to do with Hamas. It's a food, okay? We eat it, they eat it.
It's vegetarian, it's healthy, it's beans.
Bruno and Borat not only are played by the same actor, but come from the same source. Da Ali G Show, a sketch comedy series that premiered in the United States on HBO. Ali G, a cocky but dumb white rapper wannabe, is yet another Sacha Baron Cohen alter ego. When promoting his film or TV projects, the actor usually prefers to stay in character. But when Terry Gross spoke to Sacha Baron Cohen in 2007, he agreed to speak to her as himself. They talked about his Bruno, Borat, and Ali G, but let's begin with a clip from Borat. In this scene, he's taking a driving lesson.
My name is Mike. I'm going to be your driving instructor. Welcome to our country, okay?
My name is Borat.
Okay, good. Well, I'm not used to that, but that's fine.
You use two hands now.
What?
Two hands.
But then it looked like I am holding a gypsy while he eats my crumb.
I don't care what it looks like. You use two hands when you drive, okay?
Okay. You want to have a drink?
You can't drink there while you're driving.
Why not?
It's against the law.
What? Look, there is a woman in a car. Can we follow her? And maybe make a sexy time with her?
No.
Why not?
Because a woman has a right to choose who she has sex with.
What?
How about that? Isn't that amazing?
You jerk?
There must be consent. How about that? That's good, huh?
It's not good for me.
Sacha Baron Cohen, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, lots of comics have created characters that they do in sketches, like everybody on Saturday Night Live. But you take your characters into the real world, which is part of what makes it so incredible. How did you start doing that?
I started about 10 years ago. I was doing a TV show in London. And I was doing an early form of a character that I used to do called Ali G, who's a kind of hip-hop journalist, a wankster reporter. And at the time, he was just... it was just a character that I was recording, you know, little segments for. And then I went out onto the street to record a particular segment, and I saw this group of skateboarders, and the director I was with gave me a little nod, and I went up to them and approached them and started interacting with them in character. And then to my surprise, they actually took me seriously. And when I was doing some kind of terrible skateboarding tricks, they were laughing at me and they were mocking me. And then after a couple of minutes, I went back to my normal voice and I said, you know, this is a character. And they were really surprised. At which point I realized that people would believe me when I, when I did this character. So a tourist bus suddenly turned up. I jumped on it with the camera, kind of commandeered the tourist bus, got dropped off, went into a pub, started breakdancing. The police were called, went into the offices of this major multinational, asked to see my father on the 14th floor. The police were called again. And suddenly I realized there was this, there was never a question of whether I was actually the character or not, but there was this incredibly exciting form of comedy that I was suddenly in the middle of.
Once you realized you could do it, why did you want to keep doing it? What could you do that way that you couldn't do with regular comedy on a stage?
Well, I think there was an added element of satire. For example, when I first started doing Borat, I realised that it was a way to get people to really open up. And at the time, you know, I realised that documentary was essentially, you know, one of the ultimate aims of documentaries were to make people feel so comfortable that they would forget the cameras were there and they'd really say their true feelings. And here was a way, you know, by creating a foreign character where people would really explain what they genuinely felt about particular subjects, but immediately. You wouldn't have to leave a camera in the room for 3 months before they'd start opening up.
Well, you know, as you say, you know, you created this character who is seemingly like really warm and lovable, although naive. But what he's saying is so horrible. It's so like sexist and anti-Semitic. And so people don't know how to react to him, of course. And, you know, he's so like unenlightened, but the real person who he's talking to is always put on the spot. Are they going to agree with the things that he's saying? Are they going to argue with him? Are they going to hold their tongue out of politeness? Are they going to hold their tongue because they're on camera? I mean, so, gosh, like you're really putting people on the spot. What's it like for you to be in character watching people be so uncomfortable as they try to figure out what they should do?
I mean, it's interesting, you know, it's fascinating to see how people are going to react. And it's exciting however they react, you know. When I was in the country and western bar in Tucson, Arizona, singing Throw the Jew Down the Well, I didn't know that the crowd were going to, you know, start chanting along and start singing Throw the Jew Down the Well. Or even that certain members of the audience would start miming horns. But... You know, but it's exciting waiting to see what the response is, whether people are going to answer with integrity or whether they're going to, you know, reveal certain prejudices that they have. And I think, you know, part of the enjoyment of watching it is the space between the question and the answer, where you're waiting to see how the person will react. You know, for example, there's a moment in the movie where Borat asks, you know, what is the best gun to defend from a Jew? And there is that moment, there's about 2 or 3 seconds before the gun shop owner answers, you know, and goes, actually, it's this, the Magnum 54 or whatever. So I think there's that's part of the enjoyment, actually.
It's terrifying, know. Though, when he says that, isn't it? It's like Borat has asked him what's the best gun to kill a Jew, and he has an answer. It's just really scary.
Yeah, it really is terrifying that you can go into a gun shop in certain parts of the country and get advised on the best gun to defend yourself from a Jew.
Well, I'm glad
and actually, yeah. sorry, there was a lot of that interview that we didn't actually show. There's about 20 minutes of Borat asking him, you know, but I want the gun that, you know, shoot them very clearly because they can jump. They can jump very fast. And he goes, yes, I know, you know, you got to, you know, this one's great, you know. You know, and sort of questions like, will this gun be able to shoot the horns of a Jew from 50 meters? And he's like, you know, yes, it's, you know, that'll be fine, you know. So it was a long, protracted discussion of, you know, the perfect technical rifle to defend yourself from a member of the Semitic tribe.
I'm glad you mentioned Throw the Jew Down the Well, the song that you sang at a bar in Tucson. That was actually in the Ali G show, but not in the Borat
movie. Yeah, that's
movie.
Right.
And you're doing this in character as Borat. I think this is like one of the most brilliant pieces of comedy that I know of.
Thank you. That's very kind.
I love it. You're in this bar and as this character from Kazakhstan, and the song starts, in my country there's a problem, and that problem is transport. Okay, so far so good. But the next verse is, in my country is a problem, and that problem is the Jew. And then the refrain is, throw the Jew down the well so my country can be free. And it's kind of an idiot's version of the final solution.
Yep. I mean, I think Borat's impression of Jews is really, you know, has its origins in the medieval ages, you know. So his Jew has horns, you know, it is that kind of medieval anti-Semitic portrayal of, you know, this demonic creature. And that's why, for example, in The Running of the Jew, the Jews are these huge challah and cleaver holding monsters, you know, with green faces and warts that are chasing, you know, the poor innocent Kazakh men.
Why don't we hear a little bit of Throw the Jew Down the Well, which is on the Borat CD.
If you see the Jew coming, you must be careful of his teeth. You must grab him by his money. And I tell you what to do. Everybody, throw the Jew down the well. So my country can be free.
That's Sacha Baron Cohen singing as in the character of Borat from the Borat CD. You said that you didn't expect that the people in the bar would be clapping as you sang the song. So what was your reaction when people were really getting into it? Do you think that that meant that they were anti-Semitic, or maybe they weren't really paying attention to the lyrics? Maybe it was noisy and it was hard to hear. Like, how do you interpret it?
That's an interesting question. Firstly, it was very clear what I was saying. So everyone, you know, was clearly heard Throw the Jew Down the Well, and they were singing along, and I sang it a number of times. The question is, does it reveal their anti-Semitism? You know, was everyone in the bar anti-Semitic? And I think, you know, there was a historian, not to bring it down and to depress everyone, but there was a historian of the Holocaust and of Nazi Germany called Ian Kershaw, who said quite an interesting thing, which was that the path to Auschwitz was paved with indifference. In other words, you don't actually have to be a rabid anti-Semite to allow certain things to happen. All you need to be is really indifferent. You can listen to a song and just go, oh, that's actually quite a nice song, and I'll sing along to it. You don't actually have to be you don't actually have to say, wow, these are really, really offensive lyrics. I'm going to stop, you know, I'm going to walk out the bar. But it's that indifference that is actually quite dangerous.
But there's a debate, a very lively debate going on right now because of your work about whether this kind of comedy actually feeds anti-Semitism and hatred or mocks it in a way that shows how stupid and pointless it is. Obviously, you don't think that it's feeding anti-Semitism. I assume that if you did...
Oh, no, I do. I do.
You do think it's feeding anti-Semitism?
No, no, no. I'm joking. Oh. I'm joking. All right.
So tell me why you think it's not harmful. Do you know what I mean? Tell me why you think it's not feeding anti-Semitism.
Well, I think an interesting test is to see how it played with Jewish communities around the world. And, for example, in Israel, this has been one of the most successful comedy films of all time. And there have been standing ovations at the end of a lot of performances. And that's partly to do with the fact that Borat, when he speaks in Kazakh, he's actually speaking in a cross between Polish and Hebrew. So there's a deep irony in this viciously anti-Semitic character actually speaking in the ancient Jewish language. But I think the reason that it's not actually encouraging anti-Semitism is that it's showing that all forms of prejudice are really delusional. So, for example, Borat believes that, you know, Jews were behind 9/11. However, he also believes that Jews can shift their shapes into insects, you know, which is clearly delusional.
You know, I was going to ask you if you could take liberties with this anti-Semitic character because you're Jewish yourself, because, for instance, you can have him speaking Hebrew. But at the same time, I was thinking, well, you also have the character Bruno, the gay fashion reporter, and he's gay, and you do a lot of, like, funny gay stuff in it, but you're not gay. So it's like you're very brave as a comic, and
No, I mean, I'm not gay. However, I have had a man's testicles rest on my chin, you know, and it's been in the movie. So, I mean, technically, does that not make me gay?
And for anybody who just didn't comprehend, there's this incredible wrestling scene in the Borat movie that he was just referring to. Anyways, is it different for you to play a gay character not being gay than to play an anti-Semitic character and being Jewish? A lot of people feel that they can take on characters if they are that kind of character themselves,
yeah.
And that gives them liberties to do the kind of humor that they wouldn't feel they had the right to do otherwise.
The main difference between doing Bruno and Borat, and Bruno is, just for those who don't know, is this Austrian gay fashion reporter, is that it's a lot more dangerous doing Bruno because there is so much homophobia. So, for example, when I was in doing Bruno at the Alabama-Mississippi football game in Alabama a few years ago, 60,000 people started chanting, in the crowd, started chanting faggot. And started throwing stuff at me and, taunting me and spitting at me and threatening to kill me. And those kind of situations are a lot more common when you're playing a gay character. It's almost as if homophobia is one of the last forms of prejudices that is really tolerated.
No, I think the incident that you're referring to, there's a little clip of that in one of the Ali G episodes in the first season in which, the character Bruno has joined the line of cheerleaders. Is that the same game?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
But you don't show – you show some people like yelling nasty things in your face, but you don't show 60,000 people in the stands jeering you. Why did you decide not to include that?
Well, we didn't. The honest reason is we didn't have them mic'd up, so you couldn't actually hear it. But the thing was, actually, that day I knew it was going to get a little dangerous, so I decided to hire a bodyguard. But the moment that the crowd started jeering and booing and chanting faggot, I turned to see where the bodyguard was, and I saw the back of his head as he was running out of the stadium. So he kind of left us high and dry.
So what did you do?
I carried on in character. I mean, it's a bizarre feeling, but it was actually quite exciting. And in the character, at the time, I get very invested in the characters and I kind of almost believe I am the character. So feeling like a gay guy taunting 60,000 bigots, it felt actually very invigorating. And that's when I joined the line of the cheerleaders and started taunting the crowd, because I knew it was almost sacrilegious to them for a gay man to be standing on their football pitch. And actually, the funny thing was, a few years later, I went down to Alabama to shoot Talladega Nights. And I got introduced to the NASCAR audience at the... at the big Talladega race, and there was a crowd of 200,000 people. And I was playing a French gay character there in the movie Talladega Nights. And Will Ferrell's character was introduced first, and everyone cheered for him. The whole crowd, who were made up of genuine fans, cheered for his character. And then they introduced my character as being from France. And the entire crowd started booing again. So it was actually the second time in Alabama that I'd been booed at by a crowd of over 60,000 people.
Articles that have been written about you have described you as an observant Jew. And it's surprising to some people that you are practicing in your religion. I think it's surprising because you break so many taboos with your humor. And in your humor, like, nothing's sacred. So the fact that in your life some things really are sacred might come as a surprise to people?
Well, I should probably qualify that. I mean, I wouldn't say that I'm a religious Jew. I'd say that I'm very, very proud of my Jewish identity. I'm proud to be a Jew. And there are certain things that I do that are, Jewish customs and traditions. Friday night, I enjoy being with my family when I'm in England and, we'll light the candles and... a couple of times a year I will go to synagogue. And I try and keep kosher as well. So those are things, but they're not really derived from... They're not really because I'm religious. They're more kind of traditional things, and they're things that that I do because I'm, culturally and historically, proud of my Jewish identity.
Can I ask what your bar mitzvah was like?
Yes, I actually provided the entertainment. I was very into breakdancing at the time.
breakdancer?
I was a breakdancer. Yeah, I was a breakdancer. And I put down the linoleum on the floor of the marquee, and me and my crew performed for about an hour and a half.
Oh, that's so great. There's a scene in an evangelical church in which, as Borat, you are saved, and people are praying over you, and they're speaking in tongues, and present at the church are both a congressman and a state Supreme Court chief justice. This struck me as one of the most unusual scenes I've ever seen in movies, because here you are, a Jewish actor in character as this Kazakh anti-Semite who's in this church getting saved. And, of course, nobody in the church seems to know that you're an actor doing all of this. So I don't know where to start. Let's start with, was it uncomfortable for you impersonating somebody who is Christian and getting saved in a church and having people really kind of praying for you?
I mean, the interesting thing about that scene was that it worked exactly as we needed it to work. Because essentially the film was very experimental. We had two things that we had to accomplish in each scene. Each scene had to be funny, but it also had to achieve a certain story beat. It had to push the story forward. And that really had never really been done before in a movie. And so in that particular scene, Borat was at his lowest point. He starts the scene at his lowest point ever. You know, he's contemplating suicide. He's almost killed himself the night before. He decides not to kill his chicken. He's given up on his dream of marrying Pamela Anderson after finding out that she's no longer a virgin. And, you know, he really is at his lowest point ever. And so we needed a scene where he'd leave the end of Act 2 and emerge into Act 3 reinvigorated, with full of life and with this renewed sense of purpose and a renewed mission to actually wed and bed Pamela Anderson. And the church was the perfect opportunity to do that. And the interesting thing was actually writing the scene, and I have to say that a lot of the scenes, you know, we wrote a kind of rough script of how we thought people would react and what we wanted from the scene. So we knew the beginning of the scene and how this we wanted the scene to actually, you know, go. And the weird thing was that the church pastor was so predictable that he actually almost said everything that we anticipated him saying.
Like?
So, for example, when, you know, Borat goes, "Who can save me? No one can save me." We wrote in the script, the pastor says, "There is someone who can save you. Jesus can save you." And that's almost word for word what he actually said. So that was the bizarre thing, was that it was, the man was such a fundamentalist that he became incredibly predictable.
Well, you know, this scene is just kind of gripping, and it just raises so many questions about how you felt, you know.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you how I felt. I mean, it was a very, very strange experience as an actor. I mean, I totally lost myself in the role at that point. You know, when they actually started, you know, saving Borat, I was there, and it's just so overwhelming because you have about six men, you know, pressing on you at the time. I had a man on either side holding my arms, and actually, interestingly enough, they start shaking your arms. So it looks like you're possessed, or you're suddenly seized by this greater force. And then, there's not much oxygen there. The pastor was shouting at me and saying, "You can speak in tongues now, you can speak in tongues." And so when you actually start moving your tongue and start speaking, they're so excited that it's this really overwhelming experience. So it was really bizarre, you know.
So what do the people in the church know when you got there? Or like typically, what do people know? What kind of release form do you give them? What does the crew tell them about what to expect?
They were told that there's a foreign journalist who's coming to do a piece on you know, that particular church. And he's at a low point in his life at the moment. He's had a particularly tough time while crossing America. And he might be looking for some kind of spiritual salvation.
Do people ever feel betrayed afterwards when they see what the film really is?
I think most people don't. I think 99% of people don't. You know, a lot of them hear about it. And I've obviously been doing this for many years. A lot of them hear about it through their kids who suddenly call them up and go, Dad, you're on TV, you're on the Ali G show. And they suddenly, you know, achieve this kind of street cred.
So they don't know until then? Like, you never go back to them and say, guess what? It was all like kind of candid camera or something. And they don't find out until someone tells them.
Yeah, they don't find out until it goes on TV or, you know, on the film. And that, you know, that's something that I'm quite rigorous about in that from the moment they meet me to the moment I leave, I'm fully in character. You know, we didn't want to ever have that kind of, hey, gotcha moment where they go, right, it was a joke. You know, because we want it to be a kind of real experience. But for example, it does, there are certain people that, who are initially upset by it and then actually realize that it was actually beneficial for their careers or for their status. For example, there was a famous socialist politician in London called Tony Benn, who used to be actually Lord Benn but gave up his title. And I interviewed him as Ali G, and afterwards he found out and he was very upset. But he wrote an article in the Times about a month later expressing how his initial feeling was that of betrayal and upset that this guy had, you know, basically hoodwinked him. But then he later explained in the article that he felt that he actually had become a fan of, you know, the whole show and a fan of, you know, had started loving the character of Ali G because the character of Ali G had actually given him an opportunity to explain to people finally what he actually believed, what socialism was. And because he had this ignoramus in the room with him who was espousing the most right-wing and totally selfish attitudes, he was able to kind of put down Ali G and really put his viewpoint across. So I think there's lots of people who, you know, really benefit from being in the film and, you know, being in the show before that.
You know, in taking your characters into the real world, you're also taking physical comedy into the real world. And slapstick and physical comedy is some of like the oldest stuff in comedy, like from vaudeville in the early days of movies. And it's hard to do that in a fresh way. But you're incredible. I mean, like, there's a scene in the Borat movie in which you're in an antique store. And it's not a very high-priced antique store, but it's an antique store. And suddenly you start falling and, like, knocking over all the dishes. And then each time you pick yourself up, you start falling over and knocking off more. And it's really hysterical because it's in the real world. And, of course, the owner is just horrified looking at everything that's being ruined. And I'm thinking, too, as I watch it, that this isn't like special effects China. This is like real stuff. You could really hurt yourself. I mean, it's very risky slapstick in a way that I think slapstick usually isn't.
Yeah, well, it was. Actually, funnily enough, I did cut myself and I was actually bleeding for the remainder of the scene. So we actually cut for a little bit while I went off to the bathroom and washed off some of the blood. But that was a tough physical set piece because I knew the rough configuration of the shop. What happens beforehand, before each scene, is the director, Larry Charles, comes into the van and draws out the location so I can kind of visualize it in my mind. And by the way, at that point, I'm actually Borat. So he's speaking to me. He's speaking to this Kazaki reporter. Mm-hmm. And I'm answering, yes. And I said, but, you know, maybe we put the camera here. Is the, you know, are the antiques over here? You know, so we're discussing the actual scene and he's drawing it all out. So I knew, I realized where those antiques were and I knew I had one chance to knock over all the cheapest antiques in the shop, you know, you know, we'd intentionally positioned all the cheapest antiques in one particular area of the shop, so that the scene wouldn't cost too much money, and so that we wouldn't also so that we wouldn't cause any real upset to the people there. But I knew, I had one take to get it right, and it was quite a tough set piece. I knew I had to fall over, then slip on this truck, then fall backwards, then put my head down to, pick something up, stand up, knock a table over, and then fall backwards again, and then fall onto the floor. And so it was this, really convoluted routine. And luckily it worked.
One of the things I love about Borat is that, he's such a funny character. He makes kind of sex in the human body so unappetizing.
Thank you, I take that as a compliment.
The costumes
that's
that you
actually,
wear.
That is actually my body.
No, I know.
I have to say, Borat's body and my body.
It's the clothing, though. It's the clothing.
Thank you. The mesh underwear,
that jockstrap bikini that
yeah.
that wraps around his... That's supported by a strap that goes around his neck.
Yeah, well, I must say, actually, that Borat's underwear and is actually provided by my father. That was my dad's underpants.
Seriously?
Yeah, those are my dad's underpants, which are actually made by the Norwegian Navy. There was one occasion where I actually lost my underpants as Borat. I was doing a scene, which actually didn't make it into the movie, where Borat, strapped for cash, starts work as a door-to-door salesman. And he goes into one house, and he's trying to sell them, subscriptions to the local newspaper. And while he's there, by the way, he hasn't washed, he's very poor. He goes, can I use a bathroom, please? And Borat emerges about 5 minutes later, naked, apart from he's wrapped in a towel, which is their towel. And he's holding one of their toothbrushes and going, which toothpaste can I use? At which point I was thrown out of the house by this family. They called the police. And so I'm standing outside in a towel, which does not belong to me. And I can hear police sirens getting closer and closer. And I'm looking to the director going, what do I do? And I was thinking in my mind.
You're still in
character. Obviously, I'm still in character. And I'm thinking my costume is in the bathroom of this house. I'm standing in a towel that does not belong to me. Now, if I run into the van and, we make a getaway before the police come, it means that I'm actually stealing some property, so I can be done for theft. However, if I take the towel off, I can be done for indecent exposure. So I was in this terrible dilemma. What do I do? And the, sirens were getting louder and louder. And in the end, I just ran into the van and, I hid underneath the seat and got on the phone to my lawyer. still, by the way, in character going, hello, what do I do? I do not want to be done for indecent exposure. Do I throw out the towel? Do I throw the towel out? And finally, I was taken to a safe location, and we negotiated to get the costume back and the underpants.
Why did you have to talk to your lawyer at that point in persona?
Why did I have to be in persona? I don't know. Basically, during the days, I stay as Borat. So I wake up, and then from the moment I get into the crew van till the moment I get home, I stay as Borat.
And if the police arrested you, would you stay as Borat?
Yeah, I mean, the police did come, and we had, I think there were 42 or 43 occasions where law enforcement agencies came and, stopped the scene for whatever reason. And that ranged from the NYPD to the FBI to the Secret Service. And whenever they stopped me, I stayed in character because I never knew if it was something that we could use for the actual movie. So when the Secret Service, started questioning me outside the White House because they were convinced that we were terrorists because we were driving in an ice cream van past the White House, so we were clearly Al Qaeda. I stayed in character because you never know when it's going to be something that's useful, and that happened a number of occasions. The film became increasingly hard to do because various law enforcement agencies were intent on stopping production or arresting, you know, me. And we had a rule which was basically that I couldn't get arrested, because if I got arrested because I'm not a US citizen, it would essentially mean that production would have stopped. But along the way, there were various other people that got arrested. So within the first week of shooting, actually the first Wednesday night, the line producer and the first AD were arrested and spent a night in jail. So there was always this constant fear of being arrested and trying to get the scene and trying to get the comedy before the police turned up.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sacha Baron Cohen, and he does Borat, Ali G, and Bruno. And I want to just ask you a couple of Ali G questions. You know, I've had several debates with friends of mine about whether the character of Ali G, who is this kind of hip-hop wannabe, who hosts his own TV show, and of course you do the character of Ali G, it's always unclear to me whether he's a white hip-hop wannabe or whether he's a Muslim hip-hop wannabe, because, you know, he has the name of Ali. He might be of Arabic descent and living in London and really want to be a hip-hop gangster. So straighten me out.
You know what? I'd prefer not to. I think it's important, actually, to keep that ambiguity. I mean, the important thing about Ali G is that he's not black. And he is delusional. So he believes that he is a black hip-hop artist from Staines, and he believes that his neighbourhood is a rough ghetto when in fact it is this lovely, leafy, middle-class suburb outside Windsor where swans swim under the beautiful bridge. So I think that's really what it is. It's about a guy. It's not important really whether he's Arabic or whether he's Jewish or whether he's Greek. It's important that he's deluded, really.
You've done characters like Ali G and Borat in the United States and in England. Are there a lot of differences between what the character does in both countries and what the reactions to the characters are?
There are subtle differences, and there are certain people and certain types of people that certain characters work better with. So, for example, in England, Ali G and Borat worked very well with the upper class because they were so polite that they would, you know, keep this person in their room. You know, members of the working class might have thrown him out. Members of the middle class might not have revealed themselves as much. And then, you know, there were certain sectors of society here in America that were also, you know, ideally suited for, you know, certain various characters. So we found that the Deep South was ideally suited for Borat because people were so polite and so welcoming of strangers and also so proud of their American heritage that they would, you know, talk to this person about American society and about American values, you know, for an hour and a half.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
No, thank you very much for having me on. I've appreciated it.
Sacha Baron Cohen speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. His new movie Bruno, in which he stars as a flamboyantly gay fashion reporter from Austria, premiered last week. Hump Day is the latest example of what has been called bromantic comedy. In this case, the straight male buddies wonder if their attraction might go beyond mere friendship. It's directed by independent filmmaker Lynn Shelton, who likes to let her actors improvise their parts. Hump Day won a special jury prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Yet another reason to envy folks who live in the Pacific Northwest is that the Dan Savage-edited Seattle alt-weekly The Stranger runs a yearly amateur porn video competition called Hump, and apparently there are lots of people, respectable people, straight, gay, and bi, who sit around brainstorming about what kind of 8-minute hardcore movie they'd like to make and or perform in. Strange doors open in the mind. Now, Seattle director Lynn Shelton uses the real Hump Festival as a springboard for a fabulously squirmy, semi-improvised chamber comedy called Hump Day. It centers on two seemingly straight men, 30-something former college roommates who decide that a surefire contest winner would be them having sex with each other. High concept. Actually, it is a high concept, arrived at while they're stoned and drunk and lying around a bohemian bisexual enclave. How they came to that enclave is complicated. When we first see Ben, a city planner played by Mark Duplass, he's living contentedly with his pretty wife Anna, played by Alicia Delmore. In the first scene, they're on the brink of having sex. Then they tactfully, carefully determine they're both too tired to follow through, and they're each relieved they're not disappointing the other. It's an apt overture. You've heard of the fog of war. This is the fog of love. Are they happy as they get ready to start a family, or a little bored? There's a knock at the door, and it's Ben's wanderlusting buddy Andrew, played by Joshua Leonard, whom Anna has barely met and Ben hasn't heard from in years. It's Andrew who introduces Ben to the omnisexual hedonists who tell him about the competition and set the wheels of their so-called art project in motion. The tension in Hump Day is whether these old pals will, in the sober light of day, go through with that art project, and how they'll justify it to Anna, who's having trouble enough getting Ben to have sex with her. Ben and Andrew aren't quite sure what they should do, and since the movie is largely improvised from director Shelton's outline, the actors are mumbling and fumbling and thinking on their feet along with their characters. Andrew tries to frame it one way. Ben, another.
Like, we've got really f***ing different lives now.
It's true.
And I get that in the paradigm in which you live, these weird conversations are not things that are really appropriate, and that, you know, that I don't think any less of you for it, that, you know, that,
Well, first of all, let's just, like, take this down just a second. You're not as Kerouac as you think you are, even though you've got the headband on, and I'm not as white picket fence as you think I am, okay? Like, the black and whites in which you're thinking this is a little bit extreme, okay?
Talking about sex, these guys can barely put two words together without the whole thing turning into linguistic slapstick.
Dude, you're not gay.
I don't think I'm gay, I just thought...
No. I mean, you're pretty solidly not gay.
I think the same thing about you, too.
I wish I was more gay. I feel
tomorrow
like...
Tomorrow would be more fun.
In its way, Hump Day is more subversive than Bruno, because there aren't any flaming queens. Gay, straight, bi, it's all shades of gray. Maybe Ben and Andrew's manly wrestling has no sexual component. Maybe it has a lot. Or a little. Director Shelton gives every sexual epithet a devilish spin, so that the movie is wall-to-wall banana peel Freudian slips. If there's a flaw in Hump Day, it's that Ben and Andrew have less of a sexual vibe than many straight guys in buddy pictures. There's another kind of chemistry on display, though, the comic kind. When Mark Duplass sits opposite Alicia Delmore and dithers and lies and talks about everything but what he's really feeling, it's screamingly funny. And it's not just Duplass's babbling. It's Delmore's uncomprehending stares, like someone trying to play charades opposite a Martian. Shelton films all this with both satire and sympathy. Hump Day is like a dramatic neutron bomb, exploding inner lives while leaving social structures intact. Until next year's Humpfest, that is.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. We'll close today's show with this hit from Dion, who turns 70 tomorrow. Happy birthday, Dion.
Here's my story, it's sad but true. It's about a girl that I once knew. She took my love, then ran around with every single guy in town.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schirach directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inculli.
away from a run around sewer. Yeah, hey, my miss the lips and the smile on her face. The touch of her hand and this girl's one embrace. So if you don't wanna cry like I do, I keep away from a run around sewer.